I think the fact that you don't have to compute a margin of victory when you're talking about like an IRB contest in order to get going with a comparison audit is really amazing. That's kind of secret sauce somehow. That said, that now part of an election audit involves convincing the loser that they have a prior. So.
Okay, so our second talk of this session is on Bravo ballot. Ballot polling risk-limiting audits to verify outcomes, and Phil Stark will be giving the talk.
Thank you. Maybe.
Aha. So this is joint work with Mark Lindemann and Vince Yates. So in talking about auditing, I think one of the things that's very important to talk about is all auditing relies on the integrity of the audit trail. And all of this is kind of presupposing that there's been some kind of a compliance audit to ensure that the audit trail, well, first of all, if you don't have a system that produces one, you can't get off the ground, but then to ensure that the audit trail is adequately intact, that a full hand count of the audit trail would reveal the correct outcome. So an effective compliance audit would determine whether the trail is adequately trustworthy. And in some sense, this is asking, was the system as it was deployed, including the processes and procedures, chain of custody and so forth around the audit trail, in fact strongly software independent? This notion of Ron Revest and John Wax that that an undetected change to the software programming couldn't cause an undetectable change in the outcome of the election, and moreover, you could reconstruct the correct outcome without rerunning the election. So we're relying on the audit trail and its curation to produce a strongly software-independent system. And if you don't pass the compliance audit, then the next part of it, the risk-limiting audit or the Bayesian audit or whatever, is in some sense theater because you don't really even know, if you counted everything, whether you recover the right outcome of the contest. Then we have an effective materiality audit, and then here the idea is that, you know, if the outcome is wrong, use this audit trail that's been verified to correct the outcome with high probability. And high probability is now, this is where we're getting into this distinction between a risk-limiting audit or a Bayes audit or whatever, and that's we can talk about what that means, and I'll talk about that at some length. Okay, so historically, there's been a lot of discussion of how large a sample you should start your audit with, and this is a paradigm of detection. The idea is, if the outcome is wrong, how big a sample do you need, either of ballots or precincts or something, to have a big chance of finding at least one error? And that's an interesting question, but if we want the audits to correct the outcome if the outcome is wrong, the question isn't really how large a sample we need to start. The question is, when can we stop? When have we looked at enough ballots to be really convinced that looking at the rest wouldn't change the answer? So to try to quantify this, the principle is that if there's compelling evidence that the outcome is right, you can stop, and until then, keep auditing. And now we get an issue of what constitutes evidence, a Bayesian calculation or something else. So the way that, from a frequentist point of view, one way to quantify this is through what's called the p-value. So you ask the question, what's the largest chance that if the outcome is wrong, you would observe what you did observe in the audit so far, have the sample that you got, so forth and so on. And if it's very unlikely that you'd see what you saw if the outcome was wrong, you conclude that the outcome was right. So this is sort of, you're trying to disprove the null hypothesis that the outcome is wrong. You're looking for strong affirmative evidence that the outcome is right, rather than the absence of evidence that the outcome is wrong. So if you keep sampling, eventually either you get strong evidence that the outcome is right, or you've looked at everything and then you know what the right answer is because your compliance audit has already verified that the audit trail is adequately intact to tell you what the right answer is. All right, let's go on. All right, so what is the risk in a risk-limiting audit? It's the largest possible chance that a wrong outcome will go uncorrected. So on the assumption that the outcome is wrong, how big could the probability be that you won't correct it? And the risk calculation assumes that the outcome is wrong in the way that would be most difficult to detect by your auditing method. So it sort of assumes that you have a malicious opponent with unlimited, you know, computational resources, so forth and so on, who's trying to rig things in such a way that you're really unlikely to catch him or her. All right, so the chance of not correcting any particular wrong outcome is typically much, much smaller than the risk limit, because if things are wrong at random or because of a programming error or something like that, it's implausible that it will be wrong in the most pernicious way, the most difficult to detect way. One of the things that's really important to keep in mind is that the risk isn't the chance that at the end of the day you listed the wrong outcome. So 10% risk doesn't mean 10% chance the outcome is wrong. It means 90% chance that if the outcome is wrong, you'd catch it and correct it. So if you start off, now here's something closer to a Bayesian calculation. You know, if you think going in that 99% or more of election outcomes are right, and then you audit to a risk limit of 10%, then when you're done, the expected number of outcomes that are right is greater than 99.9%, right, rather than 10%. Okay. So limiting the risk is easy. All you have to do is hand count every election, right? The place to be clever is to figure out how you can reduce the amount of hand counting you're going to do and still limit the risk. So that's where statistics comes in. So as Ron mentioned, we've done a number of risk limiting audits now, 16 in California, Colorado, and Ohio. Another 14 are planned. The next one to come up is Orange County, California. They've already done one audit, but they're going to be doing all of their countywide contests. And a lot of these audits have been done with the help of what Kai talked about earlier and David Wagner's work on this open count software. So EAC has given funding to California and Colorado for some pilots and also to Cuyahoga, Ohio. Colorado has a law requiring risk limiting audits starting in 2014. They don't have a clear path from here to there, but we'll see what happens. California has a law requiring pilots or mandating pilots last year and this year. We've audited simple measures requiring a supermajority, multi-candidate contests, vote for N contests. We've audited a number of contests simultaneously with a single sample, various sizes of contests. This number is going to jump up to about 240,000 when we do Orange County in a week or so. The counting burden has ranged from about 16 ballots to simultaneously verify four contests to about 7,000 ballots, and the costs are nominal compared to the cost of running an election. Okay. That was a mix of ballot polling audits and comparison audits, and I want to talk about the distinction now a little bit more. Ron talked about it a little bit. So in order to conduct a comparison audit, the local election official needs to commit to some set of subtotals, so of what the vote data are at some level of aggregation. Ideally, the local election official would commit to the interpretation of each ballot. Unfortunately, there isn't currently a federally certified voting system that will make that possible, because the voting systems themselves either don't record the interpretation of individual ballots, or if they do record them, they try to scramble the association between the cast vote record and the paper, so you can't go back and do a one-to-one mapping between them. Okay, so at some level of aggregation, the LEO commits to the vote data, for instance, precinct level. Then the audit checks that if you added up those precinct levels or you ran the sort of algorithm that determines who won, that, you know, on those data, you'd get the same answer. And then you spot check what was added to make sure that what you added was sufficiently accurate to give the right answer, or you spot check that. Okay, so, all right. This is a complicated thing, and actually getting the data out of the voting system is hard. It's surprisingly hard. These things are set up to make printed reports, so not set up to export data electronically in a useful form. If you want to work at the level of individual ballots, you typically have to use a secondary system, something like the stuff that Hari and Maggie worked on, or the OpenScan stuff, or so forth, in order to do a second, take all your ballots, run them through a digital imaging scanner a second time, right? You've already tallied them with the official system. You make digital images of them. You process those images with software and come up with cast vote records for each one. But now you've done it in such a way that you can associate the cast vote record to the paper. So I'm calling that a transitive audit, because the idea is if the second system says Abraham Lincoln won and the first system says Abraham Lincoln won, then if you audit the second system and it was correct, the first system is also correct because they agree. They might disagree on how many votes Lincoln got, but that doesn't really matter for this purpose, because what we're trying to do is confirm who won, not to confirm the particular totals, subtotals. Okay, ballot polling audit avoids most of this stuff. All it does is it looks at individual ballots at random until there's strong evidence that looking at the rest would give you the original answer, that there's sort of no point in continuing. We're trying to convince ourselves that looking more is pointless. All right, so trade-offs between these things. So in a comparison audit, there's heavy demands on the voting system for reporting and data export. The LEO has to commit in some way to these auditable subtotals. You have to be able to go find the ballots that correspond to those subtotals. It may compromise voter privacy through pattern vote. Might take extra steps to sort of scramble contests on the ballot so you can't reassemble how any individual, the votes in an individual ballot. This is the SOBA stuff that a number of us in the room worked on. The most efficient way of doing this, which involves getting down to the ballot level, may involve touching all the paper again. And that's a really serious bottleneck to capture digital images of all of these things. On the plus side, it does check the tabulation. It checks whether the equipment counted the votes accurately, but not if you're doing one of these transitive audits, at least not necessarily, because that's then you're checking that this parallel system tabulated the votes accurately. You're not checking whether the original system tabulated the votes accurately. You might be able to cross-check subtotals so that you're getting that as a fringe benefit. But the biggest plus is that if you can do all this, and if it isn't too expensive to do it, then it requires inspecting the fewest ballots. So it's very efficient if you can get there. Ballot polling audit, in contrast, typically requires more counting than a ballot level comparison audit. But note that this is ballot level, not precinct level. It doesn't check the tabulation, right? It's looking at the ballots and trying to confirm who won. It's not checking that the original system counted accurately. You could have counted essentially the majority of ballots the wrong way and still get the right answer, right? the pluses are it has virtually no setup cost. It requires nothing of the voting system, no data export except who won, which is supposed to be well known by the time the audit starts. Generally, you need a ballot manifest to draw a sample. That's maybe a minus, but this goes in both, probably it's a requirement for both of them. I'll talk about that a little bit more. It does a pretty good job of preserving voter anonymity, except possibly for the particular ballots that are inspected. And if that's only a handful of ballots at the end of the day, there's only a handful of voters who's possibly have their anonymity compromised. And the counting burden for doing this way, because you're operating the level of individual ballots, you pick up a lot of efficiency. It can end up actually requiring looking at fewer ballots than doing a comparison audit if the comparison audit is constrained to use large batches like precincts. Okay. All right. So this idea of looking at errors, comparing the voting system count to a hand count versus looking at a sort of statistical recount, sampling the ballots and projecting what that would do. Johnson talked about this in 2004. It's analogous to, for those of you who do statistics in the audience, it's analogous to the difference between a two-sample t-test versus a paired t-test. You pick up some efficiency. So if you were constrained to examine batches of a given size, it would be much more efficient to use a comparison audit than a ballot polling audit. But by doing a ballot polling audit, you can look at batches of size one, whereas a comparison audit, if you want to use the current technology, the current official technology, you're using much larger batches, things that are like precincts or precincts crossed with machines or with mode of voting, vote by mail versus vote in person. Okay, so how much time do I have?
Seven
more minutes. I better get on with it. Okay. All right, so the intuition for this is a ballot polling audit is like an opinion poll, except or an exit poll, except instead of asking people how they voted, you're asking the ballot, what do you say? You know, what's on you, right? And to some extent, you're sort of like sampling until the observed winner's margin, the observed winner's share, once you discount it by the margin of error coming from the fact that you're working with a sample, is still bigger than 50%. So the person still won even after you account for the uncertainty. So if the true margin is really small, it might require looking at a lot of ballots. And in fact, the expected sample size you need grows roughly like the square of, roughly inversely like the square of the margin. So cut the margin in half, roughly you have to look at four times as many ballots. Okay, let me just sketch a simple procedure. This is looking at two candidates, and if I have time, I'll talk about the general case. This is two candidates, one winner. So here's the procedure. First of all, you decide what your boredom threshold is. You pick D. So if you're going to look at more than D ballots, you're just going to cut to the chase and hand count everything. Then you set this T, which is the test statistic, to 1, and the number of draws you've got to 0. Number S that enters in here is the winner's share of the valid votes, according to the official results being audited. Pull a ballot at random. I've now looked at one more ballot. If this ballot doesn't help, if it's an undervote, an overvote, or invalid, just go back and pull another ballot. If I do see a valid vote, and the vote is for the winner, I multiply this T, which started at 1, I multiply it by the winner's reported share over 50%. If it shows a vote for the loser, and for anybody else in this case, I multiply it by 1 minus S over 50%. So S is the reported winner, S is bigger than 50%. If reported winner, S is bigger than 50%, so this ratio is bigger than 1. So every time I see a ballot for the winner, T gets bigger. Every time I see a ballot for anybody else, T gets smaller. Okay? If I get to the point that T is bigger than 1 over the risk limit, so if you think of a risk limit like 10%, that's T getting bigger than 10, I stop. Okay? Otherwise, I go back and pull another ballot until I've looked at as many as I'm willing to look at. And at that point, I cut to the chase. Okay, so it's a theorem. This is Wald sequential probability ratio test. It's a theorem that limits the risk to alpha. Now, the cool thing about this is that this is a steampunk audit, right? You can do this with dice and a pencil and paper. You do not need software to do this, right? It's really simple. And even though maybe not everybody in the room, and I'm not talking about this room, of course, but I'm talking about the room where the audit's being conducted, would understand the proof of the theorem that Wald's sequential probability ratio test works. Everybody, even in the room with the audit, presumably could do the multiplication and verify that this number is either bigger than 10 or not bigger than 10. Okay, so we did this in Monterey Peninsula, in Monterey County, as Ron mentioned. So the number that Ron was comparing to is we looked at 89 ballots. The expected number we would have had to look at was 58. We got an unlucky draw. You know, so we ended up looking at more. The county staff had actually bait stamped every ballot so we could uniquely identify them. That was remarkable. So that's the process of bait stamping the ballots. that's the die that was used. We went around the room and everybody sort of rolled the die once to generate a seed for a random number generator. This is just sort of like looking at an individual ballot. You like hold it up. What do you see? We see a vote for Brenda Lewis. Okay, one for Brenda Lewis. Okay, that's all 89 ballots laid out on the table. Okay, so just really quickly, the amount of work involved is not that large, especially if you're going to be able to distribute it over a large number of jurisdictions. So in California in 2008, we could have confirmed the outcome of the presidential contest by looking at roughly 100 ballots from the entire state. Right, a quarter of those would have been from LA County, 75% from the largest 12 counties, and almost fewer than one from the smaller ones. If Obama's share had been smaller, we would have had to look at more ballots than expectation, but still a modest number from each jurisdiction. So here's just a quick comparison of what happens as the margin shrinks. So if you look at this, the number of ballots we're looking at statewide, it starts to get up to 12,000 if the margin were 51%. But even that, divided across the entire state, is not an enormous number to look at. So let me just cut to this, which maybe is the punchline of the whole thing. If you look at the presidential contest between 92 and 2008, there were 255 sort of state-level contests, right? The median number of ballots each state would have had to draw in each contest was 307. Okay, this is not a lot of trouble if you have a ballot manifest, if you have the ability to say, I want to find ballot number 1,279 from this jurisdiction. Okay, so those are Ron's dice. All right, so just to stop, this is actually possible to do if you have a paper trail. The workload is not large. You do need to worry about a compliance audit still. Coordination across jurisdictions is an unsolved or an unprobed problem, at least. And point out verified voting is actually working to get ballot polling audits in several states for the 2012 November election. So, thanks a lot.
We have time for several questions.
D is basically, it doesn't matter what you use, capital D, like your boredom threshold. Well, I mean, because what happens when you blow through D is you count all the ballots, right? So if you say, I'm only willing to look at 500 before cutting to the chase and doing essentially an unmandated recount, then that's fine. If you don't have strong evidence by that time, well, then you're just going to figure out what the right answer really is by hand counting everything else. So this is really a boredom threshold for the election official. I mean, there's some point at which it becomes less efficient to keep drawing ballots at random than just to count everything by hand. I mean, if you had to look at, say, 100,000 ballots chosen at random from LA County, you'd probably be better off with a full hand count. It's just really hard to look at that many selected at random, one at a time.
Would you go back one slide?
Yeah.
Thank you. That's the one before. Oh, that's not the next.
The last one I hesitated on?
Yeah, the last one you had before. Line. On the assumption that the outcomes were right.
Yeah.
Lovely, lovely assumption. Now, suppose you assume that the outcomes were wrong.
Well, then you'd have a big chance of a full hand count in every contest in which it was wrong.
I understand, but suppose somebody hires you and that is their goal, that they really want you to show that there is enough evidence. It's like instant replays in tennis and things like that, where you look up at your coach and the coach says, no, don't challenge. Somebody's going to come to you and say, should we be challenging this election? It's going to cost us a lot of money if we have to do a real recount according to the official rules. And you're going to say, well, let me just do a quick run here and see what happens. I think it's a very interesting possibility.
Well, so one of the ways of thinking about a risk-limiting audit is that it's an intelligent incremental recount that stops the recount as soon as it's clear that there's no point spending more money.
I understand.
Yeah. So am I agreeing with you, disagreeing with you?
I think you're agreeing in part and you're disagreeing in part.
Okay.
My hunch is that you might get asked to try and determine whether you think without too much effort you can demonstrate that there's enough evidence that this thing should be challenged.
So, all right, mostly I'm looking at it the other way around.
I know.
In order to look for evidence that it should be challenged, I would need to be able to draw a random sample of ballots and look at them.
I agree.
So I don't know how that would happen outside of some legally mandated audit in the first place. How could I get access to a random sample of ballots unless all the ballots were published?
It's tricky unless it were mandated in some way.
Yeah. So, but if it were, then certainly you can use Wald's probability ratio the other direction and say, at what point do you have strong evidence that that the answer is wrong and you should proceed to a full hand?
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. That's what I was getting. Yep. Thanks.
Yep.
This might be a stupid question, but 307 is a very small number of ballots. So why not go for 600 ballots and not do it sequentially? Because then you could add this as a feature of the actual process of casting your vote. You just flip a coin, and if it's a very unbiased coin. And then, if you're a voter, you either put one ballot paper in the box or you put two in, and one goes into a special box, which is your box.
Mm-hmm.
And you could even ask them to fill in those separately and assume that most people would fill it in the same way because it's randomly, most people are on, so. And it's very unlikely that somebody maliciously expects to be chosen in this poll, right?
Yeah.
Why do you want to do it sequentially?
I hear four or five different questions there. Let me see if I can answer at least one of them. So one is, why do things sequentially at all? And the answer is simply because that can reduce the total number of ballots you need to look at. On the other hand, I agree with you that if 307 is kind of what you expect, and in fact, notice this is a right-tail. These are right-tail distributions, as Ron pointed out as well. The median is much, much lower than the mean, for all of these. But what you might want to do as an election official to sort of manage your workload is say, I'm going to sample 75th percentile of the ballots, and then there's a really good chance I'll be able to stop by then, and if not, then I'll have a second stage. If you'd use a fixed size sample, the problem is to manage the risk limit. You're then basically saying, if at that sample size I haven't controlled, I haven't got strong enough evidence, I need to jump to a full hand count from there, rather than being able to go incrementally, you know, up to some threshold. You can fiddle around with that by allocating some of your risk to different states. I mean, there are ways of dealing with that. Okay. Second question is, can you somehow do this in the polling booth or in the, and that's a really interesting thing, that you sort of, you toss a P coin, and, you know, if this P coin lands heads, then you do something different with that ballot. I'm a little less happy than you about the idea of putting two ballots and trusting that they're copied exact duplicates of each other into different. I just don't know enough about the usability of that, or I don't have a prior on how honest people are. I don't. You know.
That sounds a lot like just doing an exit poll.
Yeah.
Being suspicious if the exit poll is.
Yeah, which is exactly what I was going to mention. And your question to me was, how would you get this data? What about exit polls?
Exit polls, the problem. The problem is bias sample, non-response. People's willingness to talk to you seems to depend very strongly on their political views. Not everybody. I mean, they're really a mess. They're. You know, the cases we really care about are cases where we need a micrometer. You know, not a length of chain. I mean, it's.
Okay. Let's thank both of our speakers again.
Thanks a lot.